Welcome to the SDG LearnCast with me, Pauline Duman. In every episode, I bring insightful conversations around the subject of sustainable development and learning, helping us all to achieve a sustainable future. Are you an advocate for education in low and middle income countries? Ever wondered how we can bridge the gap between the massive learning poverty and the potential of every child? This SDG LearnCast episode unpacks the recent evidence on the most effective educational interventions. Joining us in this episode is Mr. Benjamin Piper, the Director of Global Education of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. In this podcast, we will unravel the secrets of what is called smart mice in education. Welcome to the SDG LearnCast, Ben.
Thank you.
So let's begin with the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel, which you are part of. Can you tell us about this panel and your role? And why did you study 13,000 studies on education?
Fundamentally, this panel, the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel, was convened in 2020. The basic thing it's trying to do is pull together leading education experts from around the world. We have panelists from all over. Actually, I'm a panelist myself. It's cross-disciplinary, so it's not just people who have the same view of education. We have economists, we have pedagogical experts, we have researchers of various types. It's co-hosted by FCDO, the British, UNICEF, USAID, and the World Bank. The basic idea is that this is new to education, but it's not new to development. Advisory panels are quite common in health, they're common in the climate area. This panel is trying to fill the gap in education to help policymakers better make use of the evidence that exists. These panelists are leading researchers and also practitioners who have contributed to an increasing evidence base in education and increasing in two different ways. Number one, evidence is rigorous, so it's well-designed to be able to create a causal estimate, and it's rigorous with respect to cost effectiveness, which is a newer but growing field in the education sector. Let me boil it down. It's to provide succinct, hopefully, we'll see when you read it, usable and really policy-focused recommendations to help these countries make better decisions, but countries particularly in low and middle-income parts of the world. So the 13,000 studies was a starting point. We actually used 400 studies that hit the evidentiary bar, the most up-to-date, the most rigorous on cost-effective interventions that have been implemented, and increasingly implemented at scale. The task of the panel was to do that analysis and then to present these complex and disparate research studies in a user-friendly way for policymakers.
This paper is one of the most useful policy papers I've read. It's really well thought of, so congratulations on that. One of the things that really intrigued me was this concept of smart mice. Can you shed some light on this concept? Can you also share some really interesting real-world examples or case studies that embody the essence of smart mice?
So the congratulations goes to the research team and the other panelists who really have spent some time and effort. The co-chairs, Abhijit Banerjee and Kwame Akyempong, have done a great job leading, and Rachel Glenister has done a great job with intellectual leadership. So credit goes to them. The basic idea of smart mice is that, look, I spend time with ministers and education leaders. We think our job as researchers, implementers are difficult. How much more difficult to be an education leader in the context of economic downturn for a variety of reasons, increasing debt burdens in the countries in this part of the world that I care about. I'm calling from Kenya, though I'm based in Ethiopia, where countries like these are having limited fiscal space, falling overseas development assistance, ODA. And so fundamentally, governments using their own domestic resources are having to do more with less. And they have to do more because outcomes are bad, and they have less because of the fiscal constraints. So they have tight budgets, and so it's important they get the most impact on children from the resources that they can. So the smart bias is a way to express solidarity and connection with these policymakers, with the panel putting itself into their shoes and not looking just at what works in education. This is my field. I can tell you a lot of what I think is effective, but it's a very different thing to have a bar of high-quality, rigorous evidence and also costs on what it looks like, not just for researchers or pilots, but what does it cost for governments to deliver an intervention at scale and ensure sustainability? So the report groups many different types of education policies and programs in the categories. If you've read the report, from great buys to bad bias on the other end, and have categories where there is not enough evidence and so more knowledge is needed. And I think it's really critical for everyone to know that this idea of smart bias is targeted. It's smart bias for learning. So you could look at a lot of things, but I think the panel agrees that the most important thing is learning and learning outcomes. So it's how effective these various categories of interventions and very specific interventions are to improve learning most cost effectively.
Do you have some examples of smart bias?
I wanted to highlight the two that I think have been upgraded in this version of the report. There was a version of the report in 2023 that follows on from a pre-COVID 2020 report. And the things that have shifted in this report, in the smart bias, the great bias, is actually what they're called, the great bias eyes category, are two. And they're actually interesting because they have one thing in similarity, which is that they're focused on the classroom. They're focused on helping teachers to teach better. The two new great bias are structured pedagogy, which I'll talk about in a second, and then teaching at the level of the child instead of their age or their grade. So let me tell you what structured pedagogy means. This is about helping teachers teach better. The sector is showing that a lot of interventions call themselves structured pedagogy, but the panel defines this as a coherent, coordinated, and combined package that includes lesson plans for teachers, learning materials for kids, often at a one-to-one ratio, skill-based ongoing teacher training, and teacher mentoring or coaching that reinforce improved practice. But the key thing is that all four of those things, lesson plans, student materials, teacher training, and teacher support or coaching, all integrate. So you're not just training theoretically on random things in the area of literacy. You're training the teacher specifically on how to teach this often phonics-based integrated literacy program more effectively. And just to emphasize that the most effective version of this for literacy often includes phonics-based approaches that provide step-by-step support to teachers. Structured pedagogy is not only in the literacy area. There's quite a few programs that are in numeracy as well. But right now we have strong evidence that this structured pedagogy approach can improve learning at large scale and at low cost. And there's evidence for many countries for this. India, Kenya, Liberia, South Africa, amongst many others that have shown improvements in this sort of thing. Senegal, Ghana, Nigeria, just others that are coming to mind as we're talking. A second one is called teaching at the level of the child. One of the things that many countries struggle with is that there's a task for the curriculum, which is to teach the kids a particular things that the curriculum designers have decided are age appropriate. But often, given the weaknesses in systems and various other reasons, kids are not coming to that grade two, let's say, with the requisite skills that you assume. But the challenge for the teacher is my job is to teach what this grade two curriculum says. And if my kids are far below that, how do I manage that? That's where the idea of teaching the level of the child comes in. This is providing targeted help for children at various levels. You assess the kids, all the kids in your classroom, and you group them based on their learning level rather than their age. And that also allows for some efficiencies because you can organize the kids who are dealing with one particular skill or one particular level in a group and have that group include grade three, grade four, grade five. So one of the most best-known program organizations that have been implementing this is Pratham, a very talented, highly experienced in India. This sort of approach has also been expanding in government systems at scale. So I just went to see a version of this in Zambia, which in sub-Saharan Africa has been the country to scale up this teaching at the level of the child program most rapidly and has some good evidence for it. Other countries that have implemented this are Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Zambia, as I mentioned. Fundamentally, these two great buys align with a third great buy, which is providing information on the benefits of education to parents and families to really encourage a system in the sector that there's actually things we can do to improve learning. And I think what's exciting about these two upgrades is that these are things that are focused on instruction. So I'll put it like this. To improve instruction cost effectively, you need to improve instruction. There aren't really shortcuts. And I think it's good now that we have evidence of two mechanisms to do that at scale. Now, just because I've said that these two things are great buys, it does not mean that every program that is called structured pedagogy or teaching the level of the child will work. That depends on implementation quality. It depends on really understanding the context of this country. And let me just make a plug for this. The panel feels strongly that these recommendations are recommendations that start conversations of the country. They are not the end of the conversations of the country. A country needs to decide what the right mechanisms and what the right ingredients of these programs are, and that will differ. This is just a starting point for for policymakers and technical experts at the country to design and decide how best to structure these approaches.
I love that then. Focus on instructions, improving instructions is really important. Just focusing on good teaching. That's the message. Not on the bells and whistles around teaching, but focus on how can they do proper and good teaching to children. Second aspect on teaching at the level of the child is also important to mention to education leaders. Teachers will need help because they are expected to implement the curriculum at the grade level.
That's right.
But it's not coming from the learner. The report also highlighted the distinction between cost effectiveness, which is different from effectiveness in global learning. Mm-hmm. The spotlight is on learning rather than access. Can you delve into this nuance behind these choices of words?
Some countries really need to be celebrated for the rapid increase in access to education that have happened over the last 20 years. I'm based in Ethiopia. That's one of the examples of the most rapid increase in access to basic education from the 90s to the 2000s, where you went from 20% to 90% of kids were getting access to basic ed. The problem has been that getting kids into school isn't enough. Lane Pritchett says, schooling ain't learning. Right? Just having a kid in school does not mean that they're necessarily learning. They learn if there's good teaching, if they're met at their level. So as I see it, actually, this issue of learning is the crisis of our day in the sector. It's encouraging to see that policymakers, development agencies, politicians, and these ministers of education have really made a shift to a focus more on learning. There was a recent study by CGD that just showed just how important the issue of learning has increasingly been to policymakers. So some people would say that COVID created the learning crisis. It actually was there well before the pandemic. The pandemic definitely exacerbated it and increased inequalities in many countries. We have really emphasized in the report the programs that have had a positive effect on learning. Governments in low and middle income countries are rightly concerned about transition rates into secondary school, job creation, youth unemployment, economic prosperity, stability and growth. And these are things that they're worried about, and they should be. But I think one of the things that the evidence shows is that this issue of learning and better foundational learning outcomes is a real strategic pathway toward achieving these goals. You can't provide technical vocational training for young people that would meet the needs of the job market if the kid can't read, if the young person doesn't have the basic numeracy skills. Many of the challenges that governments are facing in this kind of job creation issue can really be addressed by better learning outcomes. This issue is one that the panel thinks is important. It's learning that matters. It's not just schooling.
There are new studies. There are more evidence into what we should prioritize. There are a lot of policies, interventions that are being suggested out there. But what we need to make sure of is that all of these interventions contribute to a coherent education system. Mm-hmm. Can you describe the characteristics of an education system that is truly oriented to learning?
Yeah, just to say it again, because the panel really wants to emphasize this. These are starting points for conversation. You'll find some interventions that are in each of these categories, the great buys, the good buys, et cetera. But all the work really has to happen at the country level. So taking a standalone intervention or project without taking into account context are just not the solution. But more importantly is, how does this link into the system? How does this connect into the behavior of mid-level civil servants who are busy and now there's one other task that needs to happen? Any change or major reform to improve education must reverberate throughout the system, from the policy level, from the minister, approved by the presidency or from the prime minister, and then link down into the classroom. And the panel would say that it's important to look at the broader ecosystem for learning. And within this, it's crucial to draw the linkages between the political will on this issue. Is there actually demand to improve learning and demand to improve learning at this level? Are there ability by the system to use evidence on program implementation? Every single program that I used to be an implementer researcher before taking this job at the Gates Foundation, and every program that I was engaged with, there were problems. There were things that didn't work initially. And some countries and some systems are aligned to respond to those challenges and update and improve and change. And so you need that kind of at the system level. You need to test various approaches. I've seen several countries that have had very successful programs at the end, but have had to navigate through implementation research to say, okay, wait, let's try this. What's the right package of ed tech that will work best? What's the right package of the teacher that's affordable by the country, but also doable? And then how do we, after you get that sort of thing done, how do you start thinking about fidelity of implementation, consistency, that a teacher who is used to a certain method of teaching is now asked to be doing something different, and how do they get the support to do that so that it happens on a consistent basis? And how does this link into the broader community and the citizenry so that we actually are connecting not just to what happens at the school, but happens in the broader civil society? So one of the things I'm really proud about in this report is that there's a section specifically about implementation and scale, and several of the specific sections on various interventions that are included in this version respond on how this should happen from an implementation point of view. What are the best evidence on and how this works? The report highlights many of these key factors, and the policymakers need to view these recommendations within the context of their broader education system. Regular assessment on whether or not the kids are meeting those benchmarks, and that informs teaching practice. The teachers have structured lesson plans that give them guidance on how to teach, and then they meet on a monthly basis to review that lesson plan and talk about how they're going to make adjustments based on the learning outcomes of their kids. Training specific on this. And in the Brazilian case, financial investment incentives provided to municipalities to encourage behavior. And this propelled the state and this particular municipality to move from the bottom to the real top of performers in Brazil's education system and to be able to stay there over time. It's an example of kind of the systemic reform that's required to come alongside of these instructional interventions. My view is that there's been a lot of kind of innovation on the instructional side at the few classroom level that really needs to have the system integration and real work on how to think about aligning this with the broader incentives in the system. This is an important part of what this panel wants to emphasize, is that these are categories of interventions, but it's foolish to think that just saying that now I'm going to do one of these things is going to work unless the broader system is aligned for that improvement and supported.
You highlighted the most important thing. It has to be contextualized. The recommendations are a starting point of conversations, and we really need to look at the systems level and see how we can align these innovations, these initiatives to the larger system. Is there political will? Is there a demand? And how are the different stakeholders also reacting to these recommendations? So I think that's really important to highlight. People are saying, oh, we have to get the latest technology to personalize learning and to be more effective in providing learning. Mm-hmm. We need to incentivize with cash transfers, with food, so that we have the latest technology and we also have the incentives, the environment for them when they show up in schools. I feel like the report is highlighting that these are not part of the great buys. Not necessarily. I'm not sure if I am in the right direction, but can you help us navigate this contradiction?
I think that it's worth spending some time on this question because it's an important one. As you said, the ed tech fits in the promising category. Look, we're researchers. We're not driven by what we want to be the case. We're driven by what the evidence says. And so based on the available evidence, as of when we wrote the report and how technology has impacted learning, only two were promising, and actually highlighted the fact that even in this promising rating, that was based on relatively limited evidence. So let's put it like this. All too often, technology is deployed without appropriate teacher training, appropriate supporting materials. The tech itself is just one part of the category. One part of the solution needs to be integrated. And actually, you didn't mention this, but the investment in technology alone, hardware, is actually rated as a bad buy. Consistently, it's shown that just buying tablets or buying phones and distributing it doesn't have any impact on learning. It has to be a broader part of instructional improvement program. That said, the panel does know that there are promising and cost-effective results when existing technologies such as mobile phones or tablets are being used. Several things happened recently during COVID on this, but in the report, it talks about SMSs via phones to nudge engagement with content, which reduced dropout in Brazil, improved learning in Costa Rica. There's some new studies that have happened in Kenya that are not part of the report that I've seen. I'm mentioning it because I'm here in Kenya. On using SMS or phones as part of the classroom have improved learning. A second technology that may have potential and maybe even more so over the last year as AI has increased, which is personalized adaptive learning, which adapts that same idea earlier. We talked about putting things at the level of the child. Many of these programs now can adapt to the level of the child. Now, with the caveat that these sort of approaches that might have success exist where hardware already is in the school. We shouldn't expect hardware to appear from nowhere or hardware alone to do work. But in both of these cases, we really think the research community needs to work on evidence. So I'm a big believer in EdTech. Again, as in my role as I'm leading the global education team at the Gates Foundation. We have 10 new investments on AI and looking forward to finding out what impacts they have on a variety of different categories of instructional improvement programs. That said, we really want to test that out and not just assume. There's a more need for research in the AI space. AI, by the way, didn't start with ChatGPT. There's been AI in the works for quite a while. But I really personally look forward to increasing evidence and having evidence on the impact of these tools on learning. But my hunch personally, not as a panelist, but my hunch as a researcher myself, is that most of these interventions will struggle not with the science of how to improve learning for individual children, but the science of how to do that at scale and how to do that cost effectively. Having evidence for the panel on cost in this area is going to continue to be critically. I fully expect, on the other hand, that the world of highly effective programs that are working at scale will eventually include, and pretty soon include, increasing amounts of ed tech and AI elements. But the specifics for that will require more evidence. So I think we can see a world where AI can dramatically improve learning as part of a large-scale program, but not every intervention, not every style of AI utilization is going to work, which is why we need evidence, and we need evidence of cost. You mentioned the issue of cash transfers. Can I address that as well? So we have to understand that the main goal of this report was to focus on learning outcomes. So there are other goals that countries have, policy objectives, poverty reduction, access to education, health behaviors, healthy behaviors. But the evidence on cash transfers shows that you might have very many benefits from cash transfers, but very seldom are we seeing direct impacts on learning cost effectively from cash transfers. Now, it's not the only reason why a country would do a cash transfer, but if you wanted to know whether or not cash transfers improve learning, the answer at this point is definitely not. Again, read the work of the panel as a starting point for conversations. We would much rather have policymakers review the evidence and decide that for them, even though school feeding isn't necessarily a best buy for learning, it's a priority for us, despite the cost due to government prioritization. But we would much rather have them do the analysis and say, yes, we can see that this isn't that cost effective for learning, but still we're doing it. And rather than just diving headlong into complex work without having evidence to help them consider as they make these decisions. Can I just make a caveat? I think the school feeding programs do show evidence of learning, but the question is just not cost effective as other interventions to improve learning. So the cash transfer doesn't have consistent impacts on learning. School feeding does have impacts on learning, but just not cost effective compared to other options.
Can you also help us understand one of the terms also in the report, which is the bad buys? And what are these seductive traps for government leaders in the world of educational interventions?
This is one of the things of the report that's most important, actually. So bad buy section talks about interventions where evidence has repeatedly shown that the approaches, as they're typically implemented, are either not effective for learning or not cost effective for learning. So it might not be politically or practically realistic to reduce spending on these bad buys in some systems, but school systems and leaders really should consider prioritizing more cost-effective interventions. Investing in certain inputs is key, but this report can actually help you think about how to do that better if you have an emphasis on learning. For example, so providing school books is obviously not bad in and of itself, because of course kids need books, and of course the ratio of the books to the kids need to be as low as possible. But providing school books without training teachers, rolling out a new curriculum that has materials without supporting teachers to implement it, making sure the content aligns with the curriculum, by itself, those things don't have a positive impact on learning. That's happened over and over again. Similarly, sending computers to schools without initial and ongoing training and content that is adjusted to the curriculum may result in these computers just ending up in locked closets rather than enhancing children's learning. These points may seem obvious, I think it's important to nuance what we're saying. It is those things alone aren't improving learning. So how can we adapt how we incorporate the school books into a structured pedagogy program or link to a teaching the right level intervention? How do we make sure that the computers are not seen as a panacea by themselves? But I think it's an important distinction that the bad buys are maybe where to start. We put them at the end, but maybe it's the right place to start.
If you can also provide a roadmap to government leaders on which interventions would be the consistent landmarks to ensure both effectiveness and cost efficiency in learning that you have been highlighting in this episode, what would be that roadmap for governments?
I would actually go back to what I said earlier, which are these two great buys that have been upgraded. One is structured pedagogy and teaching at the right level. It's exciting to see that there's an increasing amount of evidence at scale inside of government systems that we are increasingly aware of ways to improve learning outcomes. That is a really big change for our sector and just can't be emphasized enough. I would love to see increasing amount of evidence on the particular ingredients, the particular A-B testing. That's when test two different styles and see what works in that particular context. There's so much more we can learn, but I think having a starting point of buckets of interventions that can help is quite exciting. And that's not to leave out the third great buy, which is providing information on the benefits of education. It's in some ways a very light cost. It's cost effective, not because it's so effective, but it's cost effective because of how cheap it is. So it's a very simple thing that you could add on as part of a broader intervention that the country or programs can learn from. But I think in all these things, we are, as panelists, really excited about what we've been able to accomplish with this report, but recognize wholeheartedly that the sector needs to grow. I think 13,000 studies sounds like a lot, but actually when you whittle it down, we only had 400 that we could use for the combination of rigorous and cost-effective. And I think what we've seen recently is that the research community has really responded and is doing more on this. So I'm really hopeful that the evidence will change. I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to update the report and have new reports that can look at specific characteristics, because I think the power of having good evidence to inform policymaking is what the rest of the panel is most excited about.
We have listeners who are decision makers, policymakers, and technical experts, and they would want to learn more about the studies and about the panel. Can we bring them to the right direction if they want to learn more about the panel and the studies?
Absolutely. So I think the best place to start are the three reports that I mentioned. So the Global Education Evidence Advisory Panel has had two versions of this Smart Buys report, 2020 and 2023. I'd start with the 2023 one, and then it had a previous report on COVID and education. So those are the three reports to start with. I think one of the things I want to emphasize is that there are, in those reports, a lot of references to very exciting studies. So this is high-level conversation. In my ideal world, someone would start that with that report, bring it to a country, and have conversations at the policy level. That policy-level conversation, oh, it's interesting, we should try a teaching at the right level, teaching at the level of the child program. Let's get excited about that. But then the smaller technical group, maybe with officers from the Department of Basic Education and curriculum and the technical supports from donors, could sit together. But don't just read that section. The section's great. But look at the underlying studies, because maybe there's a report from Ghana that's most helpful, or maybe there's something from India that most people would be most influential. Not only are we wanting this to start the conversation, do look at the specifics of the research studies to see how does this particular context match to what some of the evidence is drawn from. And we look forward to being able to have more examples of this. I think one of the things that's been exciting is so many ministers have had briefings and conversations and discussions based on this. And we hope to have more of those, and we look forward to having more technical reports on various subcategories of this Smart Bias come out as we move forward.